Welcome to Earth Renaissance and Radio Chomsky. Earth Renaissance is a program dedicated to looking at environmental issues of our time. Today we're featuring an interview with Dennis Trussell of Friends of the Earth. Dennis Trussell is one of the most experienced green activists in New Zealand. My name is Jason Sanders and I'm your host, and I interviewed him in mid-December 2005. Here's Dennis talking about how he got involved in environmentalism and how Friends of the Earth got started back in the 1970s.
By the time I was at university, the Vietnam War was going pretty strong and New Zealand was involved. And the Vietnam War, like many modern wars, was an environmental war as well as a war of politics. It was also, of course, an unjust war.
In what way was it?
They were raining poison from the sky.
You mean like napalm?
Napalm, chemicals, defoliants. Millions of people were affected by those defoliants as well as the fires.
Oh, yeah, Agent Orange.
And the court cases about that are only now entering the American court system. This is 30 years after the event.
It's crazy the way they can delay it.
Mm. And so that was a war on a people and an environment. And it impressed a lot of people very strongly at the time. This is late 60s, early 70s. And then we began looking around our own backyard. And of course, we began to look at New Zealand's history and how it had developed, how wastefully big ecosystems like forests had been destroyed, how our farmers still had a lot of bad habits that dated back well into the 19th century in regard to farming carelessly. Incidentally, I'm not anti-farm. I think farming is a great activity, but our farmers overdid it a bit.
They seem to cut down trees and even on slopes where it was unsustainable. Mm. You know, where the topsoil was obviously going to get lost.
Mm. Well, that's one of the problems. See, the people who settled here had no idea how this geography worked. Mm. They came from a largely flat country. Many of them didn't have many traditional rural skills. They had no idea about the rainfall or weather systems here, or the soils. Mm. And they tried to make it into a replica of England. Well, it's just not going to work. Can you cut that off?
So they weren't really... But do you think that over time people would have learned to cope with the kind of different soil conditions and different weather systems?
Well, we are now learning that, and you'll find even in mainstream farming there's now a much more careful attitude to these things. But it took a long time. And so as we looked around, we were city dwellers, you know, the people who form Friends of the Earth were city dwellers. We can't claim to be farmers, we can't claim to be bushmen, but we could read the history and we could see the things that were obviously wrong. And so we entered into a dialogue both with forestry industries and with other rural industries like farming, and often we were very unwelcome. I'm talking about the very early days of groups like the Native Forest Action Council and Friends of the Earth. But by and large, people gradually began to listen, including big government departments like what was then the Forest Service, which had a schizophrenic mandate. On one hand, it was supposed to produce money from its forested lands, and on the other hand, it was supposed to be a conservation organisation. So we started up in that kind of a situation. where intensive settlement of the country was still very new. I mean, it was 150 years old. That's very new. I suppose first became really actively involved when I was one of the founders of the Beech Forest Action Committee, and that was 1973. Now, at the time, the government were going to cut down about 800,000 acres, so what's that, 350,000 hectares, of indigenous beech forest and some remu in North Westland. And it was mainly going to be in alpine valleys, very steep, very unstable valleys, subject to extreme weather conditions.
Yeah.
And we began a fight against that only finally ended early in this century. It lasted for over 30 years. And that's what got me started in particular. Other things were there as well, but that's
I'm speaking, by the way, everyone, to Dennis Trussell from Friends of the Earth. What would have happened, Dennis, if they had cut down all those forests? Do you think the land would have been degraded?
Yes. And most of the people who lived in the district were in agreement with us in that case.
So even the locals, who are usually pro?
A lot of the locals were with us. Right. And we actually went out and talked to some of them. And we went into some of those very remote valleys, some of them so steep that you could barely get in there on all fours. You know, what had happened with that project is that the government or the Forest Service had some planner in office just mark on a map what valleys they thought were likely to be able to be logged. It was a very poorly researched scheme.
Yeah.
And, of course, most of those valleys should never have been touched. And they are, and I don't put it down just to our efforts, there were many, many organisations who took up that battle.
And was it a long, it sounds like it was a long, hard battle. Why did all these successive governments back such a crazy scheme?
Because they were frightened of losing West Coast voters, maybe, or because the development mindset is so rigorously locked into their brains that they can't think in other ways.
Who stood to gain from those forests being cut down?
Well, initially, some very big companies like New Zealand Forest Products, which no longer exists under that name. They've all changed their names now. But at that time, it was New Zealand Forest Products. It was a firm like Carter Holt Harvey is now.
Yeah.
And the government were basically into giving them that timber for free, you could say, because the government wanted a particular kind of development on the West Coast. It wanted a big pulp mill, big factory, you know, the big thing. They wanted the big thing. And New Zealand Forest Products could see that this was going to be sweet for them. At the time, you virtually eliminated having to pay corporate tax if you started a pulp mill. Your tax dropped almost to nil. They were going to get the timber for next to nothing, and they saw dollars. So they stood to gain. I can't think of anybody else who stood to gain.
No,
everybody else really stood to lose.
The people on the West Coast didn't stand to gain.
No.
They had a few jobs for a while, but then
of them wanted the jobs, but they by no means all people were convinced by that on the coast.
Right.
So that's how it all started. As far as Friends of the Earth is concerned, because Friends of the Earth arose in New Zealand as a result of that particular logging scheme. Because in 1974, a very astute English ecologist came here, a man called Graham Sell, and he hooked himself up with us. He wanted a group that were fairly radical, and he wanted to write a book about the scheme because it was notorious around the world.
The beach, logging the beaches?
Yeah, it was a model of how not to do it. And So Graham travelled with me a lot in the South Island and gathered the materials for a book, and he was a very amiable, easygoing Londoner who could talk to the locals in a way a lot of New Zealanders would have found difficult. He used to go into Westport or Reefton pubs and play billiards and just start talking about sawmilling and what the alternatives were. And people didn't resent him. He was a very amiable man.
He was an outsider as well.
Yeah. And he wrote a book as a result of this called Rush to Destruction. And it was published by Reeds, New Zealand Publishers, in 1975. And on the occasion of its publication, Graham also said, well, why don't you set up a New Zealand branch of Friends of the Earth? And we'll do it all at once. We'll launch the book and we'll set up a New Zealand branch of Friends of the Earth. He was Friends of the Earth in London.
Because let me just stop you there. What is the history of Friends of the Earth? Where did they start? And well, I always seem to have them in my mind's eye as being an English group.
England was the second Friends of the Earth. The first was in the United States, and it was founded, I think, by a man called David Brower, who was an extraordinary man. And David Brower has just left us. He died a couple of years ago in his 80s. And he founded several organisations in the United States. Friends of the Earth was one of them.
Really?
And then England started the Friends of the Earth, and Graham Sell was one of the founding workers for them.
One of the main movers and shakers.
And I don't know in what order we were, but now Friends of the Earth is in many countries.
Yeah.
And the New Zealand one started in 1975, and it's fought about many issues. Forest, but it was the forest issue that started it.
Yeah, that's where you made the connection with Graham Sell.
Yeah,
and that's a very good story to tell, really, because you won that battle in the end, didn't you?
Well, in the end, although I can't claim credit for it, by the time that battle ended, I was really working full time as a musician and writer, but I was trying to help in small ways, like giving people some money if I play a concert. Used to give people money to carry on the battle, particularly the most active people. And the most active people by the end of the battle, this is in the early 2000s, was a largely Auckland-based group called Native Forest Action.
Right.
They were really good, those guys. And they went up the trees and stayed in the trees.
This is when...
Down in Westland.
When was this? 2001?
Well, about that time. I can't remember exact years. But that was the last active campaign in that area. And these guys went up the trees and just sat there so that the loggers couldn't cut the trees down.
And was this when the Labor government was in power? Like,
well, I can't clearly remember the sequence of events unless I go and read it all up.
Sure.
But it was the Labor government that eventually, the Clark government, that eventually said, OK, we're stopping it.
It's madness.
Mm. And you may remember that some parts of the government forestry company in Westland didn't want it to stop.
Yeah, I remember that.
And there were various scandals because they cooked the books to try and make it look better, and they even became threatening in many cases. But finally the government stepped in and said, this is it, it's over.
Great.
But it was took a long time to get a government to do that. And I think that is one of the successes of the Clark government, that they did do it. The national government wouldn't have done it.
Oh, they wouldn't.
Dennis Trussell and the Friends of the Earth have been very involved in the debate on whether genetic engineered foods are safe or not. And they gave a presentation to the Royal Commission, which inquired into whether it's safe, back in 2001. And Dennis told me about that.
Yes, we were Very active in there.
Yeah.
We got standing to go to the Royal Commission. And we put a lot of effort into our case and researching it. And I have to say that the Royal Commission was a waste of the taxpayers' money.
Why do you say that, Dennis?
Because the fundamental scientific issues of genetic engineering were never properly aired in front of that commission. And
how can that be? I mean, there is a serious, highly paid commission.
They were highly paid. or should we say seriously paid?
Yeah.
I don't want to get too technical here for your listeners, but the whole genetic engineering debate turned, or should have turned, on the argument, do genes, or rather, are genes the only factor in heredity? Are they what makes heredity work?
Yeah.
And the answer to that question is now overwhelmingly no. Genes are not the only factor involved in heredity. There are many other structures in the cell that are involved in the transmission of heredity. Now, genetic engineering was erected on the theory that genes are the only factor in heredity. It was a false theory. It is true that genes, if we define genes as being little bits of DNA, they are an element in the whole process, but by no means the only one. And that's really what that commission should have based its whole debate on. It did not want to look at the basic science. And why? Because it was politically inexpedient to do so, because the basic science, by 2001, when the commission was sitting, the basic science was all pointing to the fact that the theory that genes were the only factor in heredity was wrong. And that wasn't a suitable conclusion for the commercial interests involved in genetic engineering. They wanted this sweet, tidy, mechanical theory of life, one-dimensional, that they could make money out of. And yet many people in the scientific community had been pointing out that the genetic theory of heredity was wrong as early as the 1960s. This is not new information. A little bit of science history here. In 1953, Watson and Crick formed the theory that they called the central dogma of genetics. And it was that DNA and RNA, the nucleic acids, are the agents of heredity. And the other part of the central dogma was that information in a biological system can only pass in one direction from these nucleic acids, these very complex acids, from them into proteins. The information only travels in one direction in an organism. Well, both those central tenets have been proven false. And they were already being proven false as early as the 1960s. And there were papers being published by scientists like Dr. Barry Commoner in journals like Nature back as far as the 1960s and 70s that were pointing out that these things were false. And it was just too simple.
So the environment obviously has an influence back on the DNA.
Yeah, that's right.
It's a
multi-dimensional system, both within the organism and the way the organism functions in its environment. It's hugely complex. Watson and Crick's theory, which is a theory that the genetic engineers wanted because it could be industrialised, you see.
Right.
You could industrialise biology with this theory.
Yeah.
Watson and Crick's theory is really a crude caricature of what happens. And we still don't really know what happens because it's so enormously complex. But there are many scientists, and they published a lot of papers in this area who are now showing us just how complex it is and how multidimensional it is. And one of the most distinguished scientists in recent years who's done research in this area is a New Zealander who's based at Auckland University.
Who's that?
Professor Peter Wills.
Oh, Peter Wills, yeah.
He's done some very fundamental research in heredity. Not in New Zealand, but at overseas institutes. But he's published on these subjects. So the information was there for the commission. They didn't have to pretend that the science didn't exist. The science that said the original crude sort of industrial theory was wrong, that science already existed and was available. People like me could get a hold of it. I'm not a scientist.
Right.
People like me could discuss it.
Yeah.
You know. So
anyone with any intelligence could grasp what it means.
And the commission went into denial about those basic issues.
Did they really? I mean, what did they say? I mean, was it presented to them?
Yes, I was one of the people who presented it. I insisted on making my presentation on these grounds because others were making presentations on ethical grounds or on grounds of
precautionary principle.
But very few people were on that fundamental scientific ground. And so I said, well, I'm going to go onto that ground. I will argue on that ground that the theory is wrong, and I will produce the evidence that the scientific community has produced to show that the theory is wrong. And they never asked me a single question about any of this stuff when I gave my presentation. Not a single question was asked of me.
That's amazing.
And I saw, now it may be that they thought I was just a layman and they weren't going to waste their time with this sort of hairy little jerk, I don't know. It was obvious that I was intellectually competent. I was speaking their language as competently as they could speak it. Our witnesses that we brought out to that commission were world famous scientists. One of them was Dr. Arpad Pushtai.
Oh, yeah.
And they treated Pushtai with deference, but then completely distorted his research in their report. Completely distorted it. When I went through what they said about Arpad Pushtai's research in their report, I found mistakes in every sentence. Every sentence had mistakes in it.
How much were these people being paid?
Well, I don't know. I think the whole commission cost about $6 million. So our involvement in it was head on, in the sense that we were presenting evidence at that commission. But everything that we attempted to say was pretty much ignored. And the most serious case of ignoring it was not so much my evidence, but the evidence presented by Pushtai. And the incredible distortion of that evidence that occurred in their publications.
Well, that's just amazing, because I went to a public talk that he gave around the time when he was in New Zealand, and he showed us slides of his research, and it was fairly easy to understand.
Yeah, it's
it wasn't rocket science.
No, it's not difficult to understand.
You just knew that they were fed genetically engineered potatoes, and these rats had change in their internal intestines, their villi were flattened out, and they weren't working as efficiently, so their digestive tracts were affected by eating genetically engineered food.
Well, the Pushtai team were slandered around the world as a result of speaking plainly about their results. They were not popular. A big industry set out to damn them and slander them. And they were partially successful, and I'm afraid our Royal Commission played its role in that by distorting the evidence when they actually put it in their published report.
Right.
And that was quite unnecessary.
It was dishonest.
Mm.
I mean, they must have been intelligent people. I believe they were retired judges.
Yes, they were intelligent. One was a retired judge. Another one was a very articulate and apparently liberal Anglican bishop. Another was a GP, a doctor working in South Auckland, woman. And another one was a biologist, daughter of a very famous New Zealand scientist, Ian Fleming. I think it was Ian Fleming, was it? Fleming.
Ian Wilson.
Jean Fleming was the biologist on the commission. I think they got out of their depth and they freaked out. And there are immense pressures on them.
Behind the scenes, you mean? Behind the scenes from government and industry.
Yeah. I think companies like Monsanto, who were there in various ways, were intent on getting the result they wanted.
And what kind of pressure could they have put them under?
Well, you may well ask, you know. These things always mystify me. I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, apart from the obvious.
We're not meant to know, are we? We're not meant to know.
Apart from the obvious things that their jobs are threatened or their safety or something like this, I can't think. I think it's more peer pressure, you know. Fear that they won't conform to a certain view of the world and that they'll be outcast and then they'll be on their own and all that sort of thing. I think that's probably as powerful a factor as any other in these situations.
Well, tell me about, you were saying about the genetic, how genetics aren't the be-all and end-all of, it doesn't just go one way from the DNA to our hereditary traits. It goes back, environment has an effect too on genes. How does this go specifically against the genetic engineering propaganda?
Well, the genetic engineer who wants permission, for instance, to put human genes in cattle, right?
Yeah.
And we already have an experiment like this going on in New Zealand right now at Ruakura. He has to present his case to be able to do this. He has to be able to present it and say, I know that gene XYZ will cause, in humans, causes the expression of protein, you know, ABC. Right?
Yep.
And I know that if I transfer this human gene XYZ to the embryo of, or rather the germ tissue of a cattle beast.
Cow, yeah.
That it will have the same effect in that creature too when it grows up. So you'll get, say, human characteristically human proteins being expressed in the milk of the cow, right? Now, what that is assuming is that the gene is a constant. It's like a mechanical constant. It will always have the same effect, no matter where it is in nature. That is crap, and everybody knows it.
Everybody who's looked into the issue with honest intelligence,
it's crap.
Can say it's crap.
It's crap.
So what actually happens?
Well, the gene may indeed cause the expression of the desired protein, but it may also have many undesired side effects. And this is where the theory breaks down. Also, the gene is not the only factor involved. There are many other factors involved in the production of that protein. And they're often factors that are not part of the DNA or RNA systems of the cell. They are other kinds of molecules that aren't nucleic acid molecules.
Is that right?
Yeah. So in other words, the organism as a whole determines its hereditary processes, not just this little
isolated
satchel of nucleic acids. It's too naive. It wasn't ever going to work out. It's just a very naive fit theory. But it suited big industry, as you can see, because it's sweet, it's tidy, you know, it's like...
So they own the patents, don't they? Once they've spliced a gene into this gene, they can say we own this life form.
Well, that is, of course, the big factor in it all. And Friends of the Earth was one of the groups that pointed this out, that the patent, one of the big motivations to stick with this theory was that patent law was now allowing the patenting of biological structures. And it was very easy to patent, you know, a set biological structure like a sequence of DNA that was a gene.
Radiated food has become an issue again. Dennis Trussell gave his views.
Has been in recent years food irradiation. I don't know if you know about that technology.
Yeah, that was actually an issue many years ago in the late 1970s or 80s.
Well, it was the late 80s that it started to be a threat here, and Bob Tate, who you met here, was a very active campaigner against it in the 80s and successfully fought it off in New Zealand. But now it's sort of coming in again through the back door.
Because they're allowing mangoes from Queensland, which have been irradiated, to be sold here without being labelled. Right here.
That's right.
So there must be other things.
Well, they're meant to be labelled, but the labels are so small you need a microscope to read them. So that's an ongoing problem. It hasn't gone away.
Yeah.
Because the way they will get plants in here is to start selling produce here, so that the public will cease to worry about irradiated foods. And the next stage is to say, well, why not have a plant at Mangere, you know?
That's right. So that's how they do it.
It's a softening up process.
Why is food irradiation a bad thing in your view?
Because it has to use such deadly materials, and those materials have to be stored and moved.
They're nuclear, basically, aren't they?
Yeah, they're the results of nuclear fission. They're materials like radioactive cobalt or isotopes of cobalt and of strontium, I think. I don't know a lot about the technical detail.
Sure.
The other thing
is... What happens
is,
to the fruit and the, the fruit, spices that they
The food
zap.
That gets zapped does undergo significant structural changes, molecular changes.
Yeah.
And some of these changes appear to produce substances that are potentially dangerous. They are potentially mutagenic substances or carcinogenic substances.
So they can cause cancers.
I've never been involved directly in the food irradiation campaign, so I'm not going to go into technical details that I'm hazy on.
Sure.
But those are the basic arguments.
Right.
The other background argument is that food irradiation plants are really a way for the nuclear industry to dump its unwanted wastes. You know, they sell them to irradiators. And we shouldn't have these wastes in the world at all. That's my position on it, that fissile wastes can't really be accommodated in the biosphere.
You make a very good point. I'm speaking to Dennis Trussell from the Friends of the Earth, for those of you who have just joined us on Radio Chomsky. Dennis Trussell was the spokesperson for the Friends of the Earth New Zealand.
This is Radio Chomsky and Earth Renaissance. I asked Dennis Trussell next about alternative energy sources to fossil fuel consumption.
Dennis, we've talked a lot about some of the negative things that are happening. What are the real alternatives that we have? I mean, there are real alternatives. There must be.
I think we're choked with alternatives. There's no lack of alternatives.
Because if you listen to the news and the mainstream press and the average person on the street, there doesn't seem to be any alternatives. Solar power is just this little sort of eccentric thing to do. You know, a few people put them on their roofs. There's no subsidies available for them. There's the question of wind power. They're starting to build a few wind powers. But there are lots of alternatives, even apart from them, aren't there?
Well, if we go back to the basic question of raw energy, that's a good example of a field in which there are lots of alternatives. And those alternatives have been known and researched and in many cases developed probably since the 1960s and 70s. And many of those alternatives are now available for wide-scale use. I think it was MIT. It was one of the big American research institutes that sent out a team. This is just with one thing, wind power. They sent out a team around the world to assess how much wind energy was available in the world.
Yeah.
And their findings were published only a few months ago. And they found that there were sufficient, easily available power generating sites that would use wind generators. Mm. There were sufficient, easily available ones in the world to supply many, many times the amount of energy that the world currently uses. Just in that one field of wind power.
Just wind power alone.
Eh? Just wind power alone. So...
And we wouldn't be in danger of destroying ourselves through climate change.
Yeah.
Right, this is Radio Chomsky, and I'm talking to Dennis Trussell from the Friends of the Earth, New Zealand. Dennis Trussell is an experienced campaigner on environmental issues. And Dennis, we're talking about wind power before,
and we're talking about how that's a real alternative.
That is one of the alternatives that we know is available, and it is starting to be developed, and there are other alternatives, all of which have been under constant discussion for many years. But another alternative, obviously, is solar power.
You're with Radio Chomsky. This is the program Earth Renaissance. We're interviewing Dennis Trussell of Friends of Earth. He speaks next about the lack of political will to change things and media distortion.
What's lacking is not the availability of the alternatives, but the political will to make these alternatives generalised, to generalise these alternatives.
Make them viable.
And make them available throughout the whole spectrum of society.
It seems to me that...
I mean, it's no use having a few people putting solar heaters on their roofs. I mean, sure, that's fine, but... if governments are serious about these kinds of things, they would set up pricing structures and subsidy structures that would mean that every house in this country had solar heating on it. Fast. For instance, I'm picking this figure out of the air because I haven't used this figure for many years, but I think that about 25% of the electricity that's used domestically is water heating. That's water heating electricity.
It's about 40%.
Is it more than that?
Yeah. It's about 40%.
It's more than that, yeah. Okay. Well, most of that can be dealt with by solar energy in New Zealand. Because we've all got roofs.
For sure.
So it's something that needs to be made general rather than just be the province of a few eccentrics who are prepared to get up on their roof and do it for themselves. And that's the real problem of making these solutions widespread. And to do that, there needs to be the political will on the part of governments. And that is not yet here. So you get governments like the Blair government, you know. I mean, you'll hear nobody talk more piously and... more eloquently about climate change than Tony Blair, just as he talks eloquently about peace and liberty and all those nice things. But what's he doing about it? Actually, in Britain, what is he doing about it in Britain?
Well, they are building more wind.
Yeah.
Wind machines, aren't they, to generate wind power?
Yes.
That's one thing I have heard.
But he's a good example of somebody who really talks, in his rhetoric, he is saying the he's covering for the fact that not very much is being done. He's a very good rhetorician, Blair. He sums up the problem of climate change in a way, because if you hear him speak, you are convinced that this man really does believe that climate change is a problem and that he thinks we have to do something about it. But
in terms of hard policy,
not much is happening. And that's the real problem area.
Yeah.
It has to be translated into actuality.
That's right. You know, I remember when Bill Clinton visited New Zealand in 1999, he gave a talk down in Christchurch about the Antarctic, I think it was. And I remember Sir Ed Hillary was there. And he mentioned near the end of his speech that about climate change was a reality and stuff like that. And the American commentator who was there with the New Zealand commentator on TV kind of rubbished it. He said, well, you know, there's a great talk about all that rubbish about climate change. And I was thinking to myself, well, you know, he can sort of say these pretty things. But unless he actually... And he's got Al Gore, of course, who's supposedly written a book on the environment, but they
actually... Written a book on the environment.
Yeah, he did a book.
Not a bad book, apparently. I haven't read it, but I'm told it's quite a good book on the environment.
Yeah, and he's going around giving talks about it now, but at the same time, he was there in the government when they did very, very, very little about climate change, apart from joining Kyoto.
Yeah, well, that is the problem of making... actual what has now been talked about for quite a long time, and the media in general, it's not that they suppress the information, they often distort it, but it's not so much that it's suppressed, it's sort of trivialized, and they like instead spend their energies on big bad crises. Like almost every day now we have big articles on the Asian bird flu. Day after day we have articles about this. Now I'm not playing down the risks of a 1918 type flu, but it's become a media hype now. It's become a distraction. And it's a distraction that, in fact, is not preparing us for a 1918-type flu at all. It's sort of anaesthetising us.
It seems to me the reality is that we're in much more danger from dying from things like cancer, which is being caused by environmental toxins and pollution, than we are from a sort of projected pandemic, which might very well never happen.
Yeah, of course, you're right. Far more people will die of environmentally induced cancers than will ever die of a major flu epidemic.
We've got people dying right now. I know so many men in their early middle age who have died of cancer already.
Mm.
You know, people, friends of my family.
Yeah.
They're dying now. They've been around for decades, you know. But they've got everyone running around scared like chickens with their heads cut off about some projected possible.
Yeah, or again, you see, the way the media play things. In the Herald this week, was it in the Weekend Herald? They had a photograph of a simulated image of a volcano blowing up in the Waitemata Harbour.
Oh, yeah, I didn't see it, no.
Oh, well, you know, it was a big scare thing, you know, King Kong comes to town. It was a big scare thing. And... yes, maybe one day a volcano will blow up in the Waitemata Harbour. We're told once every 5,000 years this might happen. But we are in much more immediate danger from other things. Why is all that media space used to scare us about a volcano that might blow up in the Waitemata Harbour?
So you seem to be saying these are diversionary techniques.
These are diversionary.
And they're deliberate.
They're a deliberate way of selling newspapers.
It's a deliberate way of keeping climate change off the agenda.
They're a deliberate way of keeping people distracted.
Mm.
And of...
So why isn't climate change? I mean, that's a big scary thing, and that's a far more realistic scary thing.
Well,
why isn't
I could think of nothing bigger.
Yeah, why isn't that on the front page of the Herald every week?
That is a mystery. You would think it would be scary enough for anybody. I mean, it's pretty scary, for instance, that the Gulf Stream, which makes Europe, Western Europe and England habitable, is slowing down. That is apocalyptic. You'd think that would keep any media empire happy reporting on that, but for some mysterious reason, they hardly ever say a word about it. Yet it's known, and has been known for some years, that the Gulf Stream is slowing down.
Why is it slowing down?
The Gulf Stream is driven by the difference in the density of hot and cold water, or warm and cold water, and that's what moves the current around. The cold water sinks and acts as a kind of accelerant for the movement of the warmer water. That's a layman's
in a nutshell,
crude understanding of it. This is not an area in which I have any special knowledge. And the efficiency of that process is now decreasing because of the changing patterns of ice melt in the Northern Hemisphere. Now, that's all I really know. There's obviously a vast amount more detail.
Well, you're speaking mainly about, say, Greenland.
Greenland,
the ice shelves,
factor.
Which are above the sea level, are melting, and the glaciers on Greenland and in Norway and stuff are starting to melt. The waters are being released into the North
You're getting
Atlantic.
Different ratios of hot and cold water, basically.
Yeah. So there's a lot cooler water now.
And because of those different ratios of water, the speed at which the Gulf Stream moves has been affected, and it's been slowed down, which means that there's less body of warm water flowing past countries like Britain, and therefore that you could be facing, you know, an ironic effect of global warming could be, of course, the freezing of part of Western Europe.
At least for a short time, for a few decades, maybe before full-on climate change.
I mean, this is, in many ways, unthinkable. There's hundreds of millions of people who have nowhere to go.
Well, my understanding, I was talking to Professor Carol Boyd of the Engineering Department at Auckland University. She's a professor in sustainability. And she was saying that it would be more like North America, there'd be more extremes of climate with the Gulf Stream sort of more or less disappeared for Northern Europe. So it'd still be inhabitable. But the extremes would be, the weather extremes would be much greater. They'd have very hot summers, very, very cold winters. And they'd have to change their whole agricultural system. I mean, it'd be a huge effect on the economies of the whole world.
Yeah.
Because Europe's so important.
Yes, the only scientist I've discussed it with in any detail is a marine biologist.
Yeah.
And she has told me, she works in Canada on Prince Edward Island, and she's told me that the overall effect of the slowing of the Gulf Stream would be the dramatic cooling of Europe, of Western Europe anyway, or should we say Northwestern Europe. That part of Europe that, you know, includes Germany, Scandinavia, France, England.
Ireland.
And of course, if effects of those countries no longer being able to grow significant amounts of their own food, it just doesn't bear thinking about in some ways.
Dennis Trussell of Friends of the Earth speaks next about the nuclear power option.
It seems to me that they're trying to slip in New Zealand, is the idea that we might have to go nuclear. I can sort of see that, I can hear the softening up process already on the talkback radio stations. What do you think of the nuclear power option as a way of cutting down our use of coal and gas and stuff?
It's not a starter. It's sheer gibberish.
Why do you say that?
Because the fundamental reason I say it is because uranium, high quality uranium, is probably an even shorter supply than oil.
Is that a fact?
It's more finite even than the oil thing. And so setting aside all the other problems of nuclear power, which are huge, that basic problem of having available cheap, high quality uranium is insoluble. It's just not there. And the more uranium you use, the more processing you have to use in order to get, reactor grade uranium out of the basic bedrocks and ores in which it occurs. And of course, the more energy you have to expend to get it. Nuclear power is already an extremely energy intensive system to establish. It's heavily reliant on fossil fuels merely to establish it. It involves very elaborate systems of refinement, of transport, of protection, because you didn't let this damn stuff leak anywhere.
Yeah.
It's just not a starter. It's just madness to consider it. Forget it.
You need a lot of security, don't you? Like with
terrorism. Well, eventually you would need armies of security. I mean, because, of course, if I was a terrorist, the first thing I'd try to do was create a major crisis in a nuclear reactor.
Absolutely.
I mean, it would be the obvious thing to do. So you're going to need armies of security. And then you've got to think about the future. If you have a material that's been created, you know, these nuclear materials that have been created by nuclear fission, they remain lethal, some of them. Will they have lethal half-lives of, I think the most spectacular one I heard of is Neptunium-101, which has a lethal half-life of about 100 million years. The plutonium, which is one of the materials associated with the whole process, has a half-life of 24,400 years. Can you guard plutonium for 24,400 years? What institutions known to humanity could possibly mount a guard over a storage facility of plutonium for 24,400 years, or much more? Of course, it's still lethal after 24,400 years. It simply has half the lethality that it used to have.
Right.
It's just sheer nonsense. It's not a starter.
Yeah.
Forget it. And the sooner that everybody forgets it, the better.
But it seems like big business doesn't want us to forget it.
Absolutely not. No.
Why do you think that is?
Because there's so many lucrative contracts in it. Why? Why is it so lucrative? Because at the end of the day, only governments, only big government can pay those bills. And if you're in business, you get all these
contracts
from big government. And they pay the bills.
They guarantee.
In other words, the taxpayer pays the bill.
The taxpayer
and
guarantees
profits,
their profits.
Yeah, your profit is guaranteed.
Yeah, because they need the power.
And yet you have no responsibility. If your reactor blows up and you leak radioactive materials all around the place, the liability situation with nuclear power is extraordinary. I believe that I'm not sure if this is still true, but it was certainly true when we were in the nuclear campaign in New Zealand in the 70s. No insurance company would insure a nuclear facility for very good reasons. They couldn't afford to pay the bill.
Yeah.
So who will pay the bill?
It would bankrupt them.
The taxpayer will pay the bill.
Yeah.
So it's a huge scam carried on the back of the taxpayer. And, of course, the bill at the end of the day is unpayable because the damage is so great that it can't be cleaned up.
Yeah.
Look at Chernobyl. Every possible lie has been told about the damage of Chernobyl, about how it really didn't hurt anybody and didn't do any damage. But the Chernobyl situation is still calamitous.
Mm.
People are still dying of it. Large chunks of that land are still unusable for agriculture. And we just can't afford it. We've got too many other problems without adding all that stuff to it.
Yeah. And then I was talking to a German lady on the street, and she said that in Germany the public are very much against the nuclear power reactors, and they're closing them down because they realise that people living close to them were getting cancers.
Yes. Well, again, what happens Of course, we know that these fossil materials cause cancers. But what happens is that if a government really wants to be nuclear, it will always find scientists who say, oh, we haven't found an absolute correspondence between the cancers these people have and the radioactivity that's around them. And this has been the case with Sellafield in Britain for decades. Sellafield is a refining plant in Britain.
Is it the nuclear power reactor in North Wales?
It's in the north.
It's in Wales. It's in,
North Wales, it's in Northumbria, I think. And they process nuclear fuels, and there's also a reactor there.
Yeah.
And for decades, whenever this cancer statistics have come out about Sellafield, and it's shown that workers and the children of workers around the plant, etc., have far higher than normal incidences of various forms of leukemia, etc. For decades, the British government has always managed to find a highly placed scientist who's prepared to say there is no correspondence between these statistics and the known exposure of these people to radioactivity. End of story. It's gone on for decades. And yet, we know that, you know, the circumstantial evidence is overwhelming.
It's a bit like all these children of veterans and veterans from the Vietnam
War.
Well,
they've been in denial about
that. Exposed to Agent Orange, you know, and they've all, the children have had high rates of deformity and the veterans have huge health problems, and they kind of just just denied it all.
Well, we've been in denial about that for a very long time, and the nuclear industry encourages the same kind of denial. And I think it's time they closed the whole thing down everywhere in the world. Let's face it, it started for military purposes. Most countries do not want reactors. The bottom line is that most countries want reactors so they can build bombs. That's the bottom line. France, for instance, which has, I think, about 70% of its electricity generated by nuclear power. What it really wanted was bombs, force de frappe, as an alternative. They wanted to be an alternative power to the superpowers in Europe.
They really had those pretensions, did they?
Absolutely. Right. They still do. Now, they weren't entirely unjustified in having them either after the end of the Second World War, because America and the Soviet Union had made it perfectly clear that they were happy to fight a nuclear war in Europe if possible, if necessary, and therefore France's response was not entirely unjustified of saying, well, hey, wait a minute, we might have a bomb too. But, I mean, this is madness, the whole thing.
Yeah.
And it hasn't gone away. We think it's gone away because officially we live in a country that's nuclear free, but it hasn't gone away. You get crackpot states who are all wanting nuclear reactors now, and they're all highly dangerous. I mean, I don't exclude America from being a crackpot state.
Well,
but there are countries now like Indonesia that are potentially very unstable states. They're all trying to get nuclear reactors.
I don't actually sleep easy with the United States when they say things like they reserve the right to use nuclear bombs as a preemptive action.
Well, this is terrifying.
It's terrifying, right?
But and the nuclear industry is associated with that, and that's its real. That was why it came into being.
All right.
And that's really one of the reasons why it stays in.
Yeah. Great. All right, well, thank you very much. It's been a very interesting talk, and it's been great. Thanks, Dennis.
Okay.
Well, that's it this time for Earth Renaissance. We hope you enjoyed the interview. If you feel like contacting us and giving us a little bit of feedback, we always appreciate that. You can contact us at nonvax@yahoo.co.nz. That's nonvax, N-O-N-V-A-X, @yahoo.co.nz. Thank you for listening.